And a hearty good morning to you. Welcome to the first Spectrum West of 2015. Good to be back. Hope you're staying warm. We're opening with a bit of Rusted Root. The eclectic band opening Friday night at the State Theater in Eau Claire. They're pretty cool. Today we're going to visit with Eric Lee about his art. Turns out he's in a transition we didn't know about, but we do now, and you'll know too before this episode is over. Jim Oliver's back in the new year with an enlightening conversation he shared with Deb Brown, who's directing Over the Tavern, opening from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild. Jim will also share other productions happening on stages of West Wisconsin. We'll meet Ursula Murray Husted, a Wisconsin native who's well-traveled. She's settled in as an assistant professor in the Art and Design Department at UW-Stout. She'll tell us about some of her travels. One of it happened last summer, a cruise of sorts, but one to a unique destination accompanied by unique shipmates. We'll kick off the new year here. Her bio begins, born into a musical family in rural northern Wisconsin. It then goes on to document all the instruments she's learned to play, her bachelor's degree from UW Eau Claire, and then her current task, getting a master's degree. Her name is Heidi Joston. I knew I was going to like her right away because she showed up at the studio driving a pickup truck. And the introduction went on from there. First of all, I have to comment after reading about you that you're an awfully busy young lady.
Yeah, I like to keep busy.
And the reason I contacted you was because I read about your New York Musical Theater Festival coup. We're going to go backwards from here, but let's talk about what got me interested in you. What happened this summer?
I subscribe to a couple of different websites that offer contests, calls for submissions, anything that if you're a composer, it gives you the chance to get your work out there. And I found this one that was a call for musical theater songs specifically written by women. In the Broadway scene, there are very few women writing for musical theater. I shouldn't say that. There are very few women finding success, finding money and support writing musical theater, even though there are tons of female composers out there. Mm-hmm. And so as part of the New York Musical Theater Festival, which celebrates new works by composers, they put together a concert specifically featuring music written by women.
Okay.
There was no submission fee, and I had a couple songs that I had written that some friends of mine had done demos of, and I figured I had nothing to lose by submitting.
Sure.
So I sent them in at the beginning of June thinking I probably wasn't going to hear anything. And beginning part of July, I got the email saying you've been selected. 3 weeks later, my parents and I and my brother and sister were headed out there to hear it.
So what happened in New York? Because your song was sung by somebody pretty well known.
I was very blessed. I got the email about a week and a half before we went out there that my singer was going to be Sean McDermott, who has a very long list of Broadway credits, as well as he was handpicked by Barbara Streisand to sing on her world tour with her.
Ooh.
I was thrilled. I was thrilled to be going out there to hear the performance. Several young people that were up and coming in the scene were performing, as well as some of my favorite composers were being featured that night.
Do you hear from people? Do people say, hey, that was pretty good. Are you going to write some more stuff? Have you made contacts? You rubbed elbows with people?
We didn't, unfortunately, get the opportunity to rub elbows. And that was something that I was really looking forward to. It just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
However, they're hoping to make this a yearly event.
Good.
And so that's something I hope to do again next summer.
Your bio says, born into a musical family in rural northern Wisconsin. So where in rural northern Wisconsin did the musical family into which you were born reside?
We still live in Cameron.
Cameron. We know where that is. Tell me how musical that family is or was.
My family is very, very musical. I've been very blessed to have grown up in such an environment. Both of my parents are middle school, high school teachers, 7-12 in Cameron. Mom teaches choir and general music, and dad teaches band.
Oh, wow.
And my brother is a senior at UW-Madison, majoring in instrumental music education. So he's going to be just like my dad. And my sister is here in Eau Claire as a sophomore, majoring in choral music education. So she's going to be just like my mom.
Wow. You were the Von Trapp family to Cameron, I think.
Very much so.
Wow. So piano at 4, harp at 7, voice, oboe, organ, jazz piano, saxophone, mallet, percussion, guitar. Composing at 18. What's the difference between composing and writing songs, which many of us have done, but we hesitate to call ourselves composers? Is there a difference between writing songs as a young person and composing a song?
In terms of songs, I would say that being a songwriter, being a composer are very much the same thing. Mm-hmm. I consider myself a composer because I do all genres. Mm-hmm. My current projects include an opera, a trombone solo piece for my brother's senior recital, my thesis, which is going to be a band piece, piano solo. I have a list of a bunch of different instruments that I'm currently writing for.
Do you feel as if somewhere along the line you're going to have to hone in on one or two? Can you be the Jill of all trades?
I'm not totally sure yet. I think eventually I'd like to hone in on one, but right now, especially since I'm still getting an education, I want to get as good at writing as many genres as I can.
We're in the studio with Heidi Josten. She's a UW Eau Claire grad, and she is a composer at the ripe old age of
24.
And she's been featured at the New York Musical Theater Festival this past summer. What do you remember most about your Eau Claire experience? Because there's a lot of wonderful mentors there.
I had great mentors at UW Eau Claire, such as Paula Smith, Dr. Gary Don, Dr. Chayu Shu, and Dr. Ethan Wickman, who's currently at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And what these professors taught me, as well as my colleagues, was just how valuable collaborating with people is. Everybody else's opinions, they matter, whether you use them in your work or you don't. Everybody has something valuable to give you.
Yeah. And the thing that impresses me about young people who are going to school for music is the fact that they really go out, and I'm wondering if you did the same, they go out and pay their dues. They go out and play as often as they can. You mentioned collaboration, but it's also going out and just doing what it is they do. Did you do that when you were here?
Absolutely. I was an accompanist here for several of the voice students, and I loved just working with them, learning from them, performing with them. It was great. My musicianship and my writing gets better the more people I work with.
A while ago, you talked about female composers because it was the theme of the New York Musical Theater Festival. Has furthering the territory of female composers, has that become pretty important to you? Because like it or not, that's what you're going to be.
The idea of equality in the composition world is something that's very important to me. The statistics are out there that men are getting more commissions than females, and it's a scary world to be getting into. But I feel like I'm getting into it at the right time because people are more aware of it. And while I don't expect to be a pioneer at this point in my life, just being present, working hard is something that's very important to me. And choosing my graduate school was very much for that reason. I'm at Roosevelt University Chicago College of Performing Arts, where both composers that I'm studying with are female.
Cool.
I believe it's one of the few, if not the only, school in the nation where both professors on staff in the composition department are female.
Musical theater is special to you. When you study the ways and successes of the great musical theater composers, and I have to give you some names, the Lerners and Lowes, the Rodgers and Hammersteins, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Sondheim, the Gershwins, and most of the composers were male. Do they in any way differ from other composers? I think I know the answer, but I'd like your take on it, because I think there is something special about composing for musical theater, because there's lots of components to it.
I think it all has to do with how well you tell the story. And you have people like Stephen Sondheim, like Andrew Lloyd Webber, which oftentimes they compose its music all the way through.
Yep.
Whereas Lerner and Lowe, it was scene, music, let me sing to you about how I feel right now, scene, music, let me sing to you about how I feel right now.
Sure. And I think Rodgers and Hammerstein were like that as well.
Absolutely, yes. And I personally am drawn more to the Sondheim.
Okay.
It's the story told all the way through with music. I feel like that's something we're so plugged in these days that if and when I start writing my own shows, I can incorporate that. You can have the dialogue because I still feel like there's a lot of beauty in spoken word. But I don't know. I think that's why people still regard Sondheim as being such a great composer. Whereas I see Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe as great songwriters.
And you must be excited about the fact that Into the Woods is now a movie.
I am thrilled. I have not seen it yet, though.
I haven't either.
No. I am a big fan of Stephen Sondheim. I think Sweeney Todd is just an absolute gem of a show. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to see Into the Woods very soon before I go back to Chicago.
Do you have any themes in your mind of possibly the first musical you'd ever like to write?
I'm not totally sure yet. Words are not something I'm very gifted with in terms of putting words to music.
Sure.
So I'm working with a couple different lyricists and librettists, just kind of thinking out, could we make this work? So I'm not totally sure quite yet.
Okay. So what's next? What's around the next bend for Heidi Jostin?
Around the next bend for me, currently my education is my primary focus. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing an opera that'll be performed in November. I have a few other projects that have upcoming performances as well as a couple of commissions here in Wisconsin that I'm looking forward to. I'm really hoping to go back to the New York Musical Theater Festival this coming year in July, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just riding on the wave God's taking me on and just trusting that it's going to land exactly where I need to be.
Oh, I think you'll land fine. Do you have any idea what you're going to submit next year?
I don't quite know yet.
Is there a theme that you have to be aware of before you can submit anything?
No, any sort of song. You just have to, it has to be in a musical theater style.
Heidi Jostin, thanks for being with us here on Spectrum West. I appreciate it. All the best. I hope you do everything you want to do, because it sounds like there's a lot of stuff you want to do.
Thank you very
and
much.
And we'll enjoy reading about you. I say that to young people when they're on the program. Good for you.
Thank you very much.
An active young lady. If you want to make her acquaintance even further, you can access her website. It's Heidi, like the famous Heidi, the one that lived up in the mountains, guy with the big horn. Heidi, H-E-I-D-I. Jostin is spelled with two O's, Jostin.com. Coming up on Spectrum West, Jim Oliver meets another director of a community theater production. Artist Eric Lee brings us up to speed on the lane he's driving in. And an art professor, one who specializes in comics, shares what she did last summer. Might be a bit different than your working vacation. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Chippewa Valley Museum in Eau Claire's Carson Park, inviting visitors to explore the events and meet the people who changed the course of local history through its new exhibit, Changing Currents, Reinventing the Chippewa Valley. CVMuseum.com. Here's a Spectrum memo. Friday marks the opening of a student art exhibit at the Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory. Amory Public School students' work will be on display through the end of the month. The opening gala begins at 7:30 p.m. Friday. Their website is northernlakecenter.org. Their phone number is 268-6811. The Chippewa Valley Community Chorus is meeting every Tuesday evening at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls from 7 to 9. They'll present their annual concert, Healing Harmonies, in March. To be part of the group, contact conductor Kathy Reitz via email at czreitz, R-E-I-T-Z, at gmail.com. Well, Jim Oliver, fresh off his best of show on New Year's Day, dives back into the process of engaging in those memorable conversations. And this week, it's a dialogue with a familiar face.
Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Over the Tavern opens tonight at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The director is Debbie Brown, who, in the interest of full disclosure, I should say, is the volunteer and events coordinator for Wisconsin Public Radio here in Eau Claire. That makes her my boss because I'm a volunteer, and so that means I work for two people. I work for Debbie and I work for Al Ross, who's the host of this program. So if I sound like I'm really trying to be minding my P's and Q's, now you understand why. Anyway, Debbie, welcome to Spectrum West.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us about the play.
The play is a wonderful story. It deals with the Pazinski family. It's set in 1959 in Buffalo, New York. And it's very funny, but unintentionally funny, in that the story deals with some very serious issues, questioning authority, of finding your place in the world, trying to find your voice in family life and in the world at large. But there's also moments of terrific humor.
Now, everything I've read about the play, and the last few days I've been going around the internet looking for reviews of the show, and even the New York Times liked it. So I figure it has to be a pretty funny, well-crafted production. So I think it's well worth the time for someone to go see it. Who is in the cast?
It's a 7-person cast, and playing the lead character, 12-year-old Rudy, is Jackson Goings. We were fortunate to have his brother James in the cast playing his brother, and his mother, Barb Goings, playing his mother. So we have that little family group there. Rounding out the rest of the Pazinski family is Anna Madsen, who plays Annie, Jevon Stangl, who plays Georgie, and then the dad, Chet, is played by Don Hodgins. There's also a nun who's typically severe, holding a ruler in most of her scenes. That's Lois Hodgins.
I always like to highlight, to a certain extent, the technical staff, because I know you as the director are in charge of everything, actors, technical people, set builders, light people, and so on. But I like to talk about who those people are who work behind the scenes.
Handling the set, I had an idea of set design, but of course I needed the experts that have done this before and know what's available and what will actually be able to be put together on stage and functional, doors opening and things like that. Bob Sessions is in charge of that. We're fortunate to have some volunteers. Jevon's parents have been outstanding with helping to put things together as well, and we just had a work day and they had a paint crew there. The Hags came and were wonderful, had a couple new volunteers to the Theater Guild come and do some painting, so that was great. Tim Menebrecker will be designing the lights for the show, which is also important. Russ Slack is helping me with the sound.
Well, tell us a little bit about your theatrical background. I should have pointed out this is your first directing experience.
It is. Well, really, theater wasn't a part of my world at all until my kids were little, and I wanted to have an option for the preschools that they went to for entertainment. So working with a couple of friends came up with the idea for a puppet theater, and that translated into a traveling puppet theater that I did for about 10-12 years or so. Mm-hmm. And then my kids got involved with theater on the stage, and they made it look like it was so much fun, so I decided to audition myself and had little parts, bit parts, and worked my way up to having larger parts, and I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I assistant directed for a couple of shows and then decided that my family, especially, tired of hearing about my opinions about shows, and they said, well, you should just try directing. So that's what I'm doing. I'm very humbled by the whole experience.
Well, you are retired from the Eau Claire Area School District, where you worked in library services. You were also a forensic Odyssey of Mind and Destination Imagination coach. What's that all about?
Forensics is speech competition, and I did that in high school, coached and judged at high school events, and found that to be very rewarding. When my kids were younger, they were in the Odyssey of the Mind and Destination Imagination groups, and those are creative problem-solving adventures, which I also found very rewarding as a coach, just guiding kids to find different answers for solving particular problems. And theater is kind of the same way, where there's several different ways to decide how you want to tell a story, how you want to play a character, and helping the cast decide their best choices for that is awesome.
She is Debbie Brown, who is director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Over the Tavern. You talked about your theatrical experience sort of in general. What are some of the shows that you've appeared in?
Probably the biggest part that I ever had was in Wit, which was produced by the Theater Guild a number of years ago now. Such a well-written show, and it was such a wonderful experience. And I was so into that show that I even shaved my head for that one. And that was great. I also got to be the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz. That was through the Children's Theater, and got to fly in that, fitted for a harness and flew around the stage. I've been with my kids on stage a couple of times, but never really in a relationship position like the goings are for this show. We just happen to be in the same cast. Someday, somewhere down the road, my kids are adults now, but it still could happen. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I was in the Dixie Swim Club and The Foreigner for the Theater Guild. Those are the last two shows that I was in.
And you assisted directed for?
For Steel Magnolias most recently, but also for Tuesdays with Maury.
Well, you are the volunteer and events coordinator here in Wisconsin Public Radio. What does that entail?
Well, I'm still learning that since I just started in October, but working with some very dedicated volunteers, making sure that production of whatever we do here at this station and conveying what's produced at other stations around Wisconsin gets on the air and gets advertised and just making sure that our listeners know what's going on.
Well, we've been visiting with Debbie Brown, who is director of Over the Tavern. The show runs through Sunday and the following Thursday through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, you can call 715-832-PLAY or go online to cvtg.org. Debbie Brown, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. It was lovely.
Yeah, that's the word I always use in describing Jim Oliver. He's just a lovely guy. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you along. Debbie Brown is sitting at a desk just outside the studio at the moment. And so we can say, break a leg. Next up on Spectrum West, Eric Lee on where his art is taking him now and where you'll be able to view his work. And Ursula Murray Husted, comic artist and professor who teaches it on a trip that's the subject of an autobiographical travel log of sorts, and lots more. Here's a Spectrum memo. The Flambeau Valley Arts Association presents a performance by ventriloquist Lynn Trebsker. Man, I hope that's pronounced right. It's T-R-E-F-Z-G-E-R. Trebsker. Friday, January 16th, 7:30 p.m. at Ladysmith High School. She's featured on the NBC Universal comedy documentary I'm No Dummy with Jay Johnson and Jeff Dunham. That's impressive company there. Well, we've spoken to Eric Lee on at least a couple of occasions, first about his amazing artistic talent, and the next time after learning that he's also good at designing and building drums, both nice to look at and resoundingly resonant. Well, he's an interesting guy with whom to talk, so I decided it was time to check in again with Eric Lee. First, a bit of a language primer, beginning with guitars. People who build them are called luthiers.
Yeah.
Now, people who build drums. I came up with some names. Do you want to hear them?
Yeah, let's hear them.
How about Abomination?
Yeah.
My favorite, though, is you're a snarier.
Oh, I like that one. Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's cool. It kind of sounds like a dog.
Yeah, I don't know. There's no name for drum builders, I guess. Well, now there is, yeah. Now I'm a snarier.
Yeah, good deal. Well, you're swinging between art and drum building. Art has the spotlight at the moment. You got off on a tangent. Tell me about how that went. You acted as a drum tech for a group, and then what? You know, I could build a pretty good-looking drum. Or did you do that before?
I had started to do it before, and that's partially why I got that job as a drum tech, is I had started to learn about drums in a more, less as a player and more as a...
researcher.
Yeah, I guess so. And what started me on it actually was I had left the area, did a lot of moving, and couldn't bring my kits with me. Mm-hmm. And when I returned back here, I wanted to play some more and get going again, and I just didn't have the parts. So I wanted things I couldn't afford, and I didn't want stuff I could. It was So what I did is I ordered some things off eBay, some shells, and mm-hmm. I put things together, and I found out during that process that I liked doing that about as much as I like playing.
Oh, cool.
And then one thing led to another, and as I looked into it more, I found I could have more control over the whole situation. I could start making my own rather than just getting someone else's shells, and that's what led to it, actually. Yeah, I got the bug after that.
So now let's turn to the art, because you have an exhibit at the Volume 1 headquarters opening Friday. Yeah. Tell us what's in it.
Because I'm trying to balance two different things, the drum building and then painting. The drum thing had picked up for a while, and the art thing dropped off, and now I'm on the other, on the rebound there, and the other way. So I really found myself sort of hurrying up. I had to recoup a lot of the things I'd sold. A collector had bought everything I had last year after a show in the Phipps Gallery in Hudson. I'm a very slow worker as it is, but then balancing that with the drum building meant that I wasn't getting a whole lot done. So then I was contacted by Nick Meyer over at Volume 1, and he offered a show, and I said, well, sure, but I'm going to have to get some things on loan. Okay. So I only honestly have a few brand new things prepared for the show. But how I'm treating this particular show is that it'll be a not really a retrospective, but a kind of show where I've come from for the past 5-6 years, maybe a little bit of where I'm headed, and I'm kind of looking at it as a farewell to the things I'd been doing, because I've sort of taking a new direction with art, and I've been waiting for that for a while.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And it's an interesting title for the exhibition. It's Violence, Penitence, and the Very Old: The Art of Eric Lee. Did you come up with that, or did someone name it for you?
Yeah. Yeah,
you did.
Yeah, that was mine.
I get two of those. I mean, I can see those in your art, Violence and the Very Old. It's the penitence that intrigues me. It says in a release that these are expressions of wonder and empathy at lives I've not led, at towns I've not built, and at wars I've not fought. So does that mean, as we go back to the word penitence, that you're apologizing for not being there, and these are your way of saying you wish you had been, or what? Where does the penitence come in?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question, because the work that's on display, it goes back to my relationship with my family, mostly my grandparents, and in a neck of the woods that they live near, Superior, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. They live up in Brule. They were a very important part of my life growing up. They're still here. I'm very lucky. And a strange thing happened. Living in Superior, it's not like Eau Claire. They didn't really get in on a boom in the 90s, really. It doesn't have the really pleasant atmosphere that Eau Claire has. It's a very different place. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's sort of a town that's been frozen almost since World War II. There's new things, sure, but most of the town is very industrial still. And a lot of these places that I'd hear stories about through my grandparents are still there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so my experience with this time and through these stories from my grandparents were sort of there for me to see, although I'm experiencing them in a very different way than they had explained it. Because in their day, it was a booming place. It was important to the war effort, a bustling port. And now it's not quite like that, to put it mildly, I guess. But the penitence part comes in with sort of today's take on older things. You know, people don't want to see this stuff. It's an eyesore. Mm-hmm. A lot of these things are very, polluting. The harbor has a number of pollution zones, for example. There's some ugliness involved. It also has to do with things getting older. People tend to reflect more. My grandparents certainly seem to be doing that. They're not really apologizing for their lives, but they're looking back and, having a sense of I'm not even sure how to put it. The best word I could come up with was penitence. Okay. They're feeling like they have to maybe atone for certain things maybe they did when they're younger. And I look at that as a whole time, a whole generation maybe atoning for certain things. I'm not assigning guilt. I'm not a person who's politically active in that sense, although it resonates with people who are. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm. But what I am getting at is that as people age and as cities age and societies age, they may look back and recognize that there are some hard times, and when you're youthful, you do things that you wouldn't do when you're older.
Right.
That's all.
Did you feel this emotional connection and this perspective to all things old and maybe depressing in Superior when you were a young guy, or did that happen after you left?
No, I definitely did. That's where I got it. It's like any kid. If you have kids and they're fortunate enough to have grandparents in their life, you'll see they gravitate to them right away.
Okay, sure.
They love their grandparents. And I was no different. There are people from another time and place. And what I started to end up doing in my 20s when I lived in Superior was I associated them with that locale. Okay. It was almost to me like they were interchangeable. If I see an old building, I would think of them. Did they have anything to do with this?
Oh.
And then it became sort of a generational thing. it's hard to explain to people who maybe live in a more prosperous or more, I guess, current feeling city like Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of that here. I mean, the history isn't all over the place here like it is there. But for me, yes, it was very much a thing throughout my whole life there. I just thought of them as being from a whole other world, really. And so living up in that older feeling part of this state and this country, it was pretty hard to get around it.
We're talking with Eric Lee. He's an artist, and he makes drums, and he has an exhibit opening Friday at the Volume 1 Gallery at the local store. They call it their world headquarters on Dewey Street in Eau Claire. The exhibition is called Violence, Penitence, and the Very Old. The word empathy is used in your statement of purpose. How important is empathy for an artist as he tries to create a depiction of something? A follow-up to that, second part is, have you ever sat in front of a canvas and just simply let an accident happen? Did you just let serendipity take over and say, I'm just going to see where this goes?
Well, yeah. Well, for the second part of the question, you know, that happens all the time. I consider what I do to be improvisation in slow motion.
It's a cool way of putting it.
Well, it takes so long for me to complete something. You know, there's a lot of spontaneity, but you wouldn't know it because there's a lot of really deliberate detail work, and these things, you know, they could take a year or more, mm-hmm. some of them. In the very least, they'll take 2-3 months.
Wow.
And so people don't generally associate that length of time with being spontaneous, but the ideas occur to me very naturally. It's a funny thing. I guess I'm lucky. I don't really have to think a whole lot about it.
The subject of your work is something that you have an empathy for.
Oh, yeah.
And a memory of. Do you embellish it, or do you try to make it the way your mind sees it?
It's the way I see it. It's, you know, to be real basic about it, it's a form of association. It's all it is.
Okay.
So, I mean, let's say you're hearing a story. If you're a more visual person, you might be imagining the story as you're hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is really all it is. It's a different way of – I'm trying not to be literal, and I don't – like I say, I'm not a very deliberate guy when I'm working on this stuff, except when it comes to certain details and certain maybe directions it takes. But mm-hmm. the ideas themselves are automatic, and because I associate so strongly with the things that I identify with and gravitate toward, it's an automatic thing. Mm-hmm. I don't have mm-hmm. to – I don't really have to guide it in any way. When I was younger, I did. I mean, when you hear a lot of art theory and when you hear, you know, things about composition and what you should do here and shouldn't do there and what makes successful art, mm-hmm. all that stuff, if that starts to play a role, it becomes less, in my mind, a little less genuine and maybe a bit more contrived. And I, there's definitely parts of my older work that has that I can see that role playing now. But part of this show is to show the transition between that and where I'm headed now. And it's becoming a much more natural thing for me to just do things.
You're letting cats out of the bag as to where you're headed?
well, for one, there's going to be...
Have you told your family where you're
headed? There's going to be a lot more color. I mean, for one, I mean, it's been real... That's another thing. Everyone's like, hey, why don't you use more color? And I've always felt that it's a real big responsibility to use color, and people get a kick out of that.
That's an interesting comment, too.
Well, I don't...
But I can see where it comes from.
Yeah, and I've wondered myself, why don't you use more color? It's not just because I'm trying to be, you know, depressing or be a Tom Waits song here or anything. It's just that it's... I was thinking about it just the other day, and I think it's because a lot of the things I've inherited, a lot of these images and a lot of these places are... They're from a long time ago. The photography was black and white.
A lot of browns there.
A lot of browns, yeah. And the area I'm from, it's just a dire situation. Mm-hmm. You can't look at it and think flowers and roses and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But no, things are changing. It was more about the crumbling of something, the sort of passing away of a time, and now the change that's coming is more about the building up from that.
Mm-hmm.
So life is coming back in. To answer
cool.
your question,
mm-hmm.
life would be color and actual living things and things like that. More multimedia as well, not just paint and what I've been doing.
Now, you're not a depressed guy. Do you see yourself being a happy guy? Do you see yourself getting happier with your art and saying, hey, look what I did. I'm a happy guy. There's little smiley faces in it.
Right. Here. Well, I have a friend who knows me pretty well, and he got out his psychology degree and thought that maybe I was becoming happier. And it's like, well, long time ago, I wasn't a happy guy. But I'm actually a pretty optimistic person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm getting happier. It's more of a... You know what it is I feel like I'm finally getting to express things that I can come up with, and I'm not borrowing them from my mm-hmm. grandparents' stories.
Okay.
So in other words, I'm leading my own life, so to speak.
I guess what I was getting to is what should your art do for you? Should you stand in front of it and say, man, that just reminds me of some crappy stuff? Or should you stand in front of it and say, I am really happy with that piece and proud of it? Is that what your art should do? I mean,
for me?
Yeah. You stand and look at it. What should it do for you?
What should it do? Oh, boy.
Are you proud of what you do?
A lot of the time.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of the time I am.
And pride leads to happiness, I would think. Satisfaction, at least.
Satisfaction's right? A good word. Yeah. There has to be, I'll put it this way, I'll know if I've hit the mark. I told someone once, they were asking, how do you start something and how do you end it? And
I think I asked that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh.
I said, how do you stand back and look at a piece and know it's finished?
Oh, okay. Well, one thing I've sort of realized lately anyway is that it's like going for a walk for me, all right? Mm-hmm. You go for a walk and either you know where you're going or you don't, okay? Now, if you set out for a walk and you have a destination in mind, the fun is getting there. It's a surprise to me if when I get to where I'm going, it doesn't resemble what I thought it would look like. The painting's just like that for me. Mm-hmm. I have a good idea of how it's going to end up, but now how I get there, that's where the improvisation comes in. That's where the experimentation comes in. Hmm. But when I get there, I'm very rarely surprised. And if it's something I recognize, then that means I've done a good job. That's how I see it.
Oh, yeah. You're full of cool ways of saying things.
Right.
Yeah, what a guy. Eric Lee, thanks for being with us. We enjoy following your career, and we're looking forward to the new you.
Yeah, thanks. Me too.
Fun stuff. Good stuff. Very talented guy. You can see more of what he does and how he does it at a couple of websites. The art is at Eric, eric.j-lee.org. And the exquisite drum work is at oliversnaredrums.com. And remember, the exhibit at Volume 1's local store gallery begins Friday and will be up through the end of February. That's in Eau Claire on Dewey Street. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center. Rusted Root brings its blend of acoustic rock and world music to the State Theater Friday, January 9th, 7:30 p.m. Tickets and details at eauclairearts.com. Spectrum Memo, Pump Boys and Dinettes is coming to the Black Box Theater at the Phipps Center in Hudson, January 16th through February 1st. You can also check out the ceramic studio classes at the Phipps for teens, adults, and kids. Lots of them. They're happening in January, February, and March. Info at the website thephipps.org. She's an interesting woman residing and mentoring in an interesting world, the world of comic illustration. Ursula Murray Husted is an assistant professor in the Art and Design Department of UW-Stout. She not only takes her craft and responsibility very seriously, she reaches for experiences that will enhance her abilities to draw and teach, like this past summer when, from June 13th to July 1st, she took a trip. And what a cool switch that is, because usually people go from winter to warm, and you went from warm to winter. 27 people on a tall ship. I want to hear about the trip. The destination first.
It took place going up and around the coast of Svalbard, quite far north of Norway in the Arctic Circle. It's as far north as people live on the planet. And so for a large portion of the year, it's completely iced in. But around the solstice, where there's 24 hours of daylight, because it's that far north,
sure.
The ice will open up a little bit, and that allows ships and fisheries to go up around it.
Huh.
So this was an artist residency, and we would go up and as far north as we could get until we got to the pack ice. So there were artists and scientists and poets and other kinds of writers, and then me, who's a cartoonist. And it was a really wonderful experience.
Who sponsors this? Where does this come from?
So this is the Arctic Circle Foundation, which is a private artist residency, and you can apply to it. And I was partially sponsored by my home institution, the University of Wisconsin-Stout.
Did you aspire to do this for some time? Is this something on your radar for a long time?
I love boats. My father had a boat when I was a real little kid, and I've always been enchanted by the idea that human beings can be on the water and travel from one place to another. And moving north again for graduate school, I started to meet people who had been to the Arctic and the Antarctic. And so I became friends with photographer Stuart Clipper and poet Kathleen Heidemann, and I met Anne Bancroft, and I met all of these wonderful people, and I thought, my gosh, it's real people going to the North, you know, the far extremes of the planet. Maybe that's something that I could do.
Yeah.
And so when I came across this residency that combined both boats and going to the Arctic, I thought, well, I should at least apply. And I got in. So that was very exciting. Experiencing the world is something that artists and writers should do.
Okay.
So that's always been part of my interest in going out and seeing these places and doing these things. And, you know, I'm sort of like, well, why shouldn't I go there? Why shouldn't I do these things?
27 people on a boat. How was that? How were the accommodations? It was a big, tall ship, as I alluded earlier.
It was a tall ship, but big is perhaps a gracious way of explaining it. It's Ooh. Funny because the kind of people who want to go to the Arctic are often romantic. I'm a romantic.
You are.
So you get this idea of Rockwell, Kent, and Greenland. You know, and you imagine yourself standing on a glacier and looking out and nobody's around you. And instead, as a friend on the boat said, my God, we're like 30 monkeys on a boat. So very rarely did you have any time to yourself. You had this idea that you were going to go have this lone, wild experience. And instead, you sort of realized what it was like to be an Arctic explorer, because you can't be alone in a place that's trying to kill you. It's cold.
Yeah.
It was very bright during the solstice. You know, there's polar bears and there's all sorts of The conditions are so extreme that being alone is not something that you can do. And that's something that happens a lot in the modern world. We're very isolated. We're very alone, despite having all of this connective technology. So it was interesting to be in a place where your connective technology didn't work and yet be surrounded by people that you didn't know real well. So I found the personal dynamics, I made a whole lot of friends, to be really interesting and to be something that I hadn't experienced before.
This program reaches out to educators in the hopes that they will, and here's the quote, foster the explorer's spirit and analytical mind within today's youth. The question is that the result? Is it that you can't wait to share this stuff when you come back?
Oh, not just that. My students are already explorers. They see themselves as explorers.
Right.
Comic students at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. They just don't necessarily know that they can explore physically as well as they can explore intellectually. They're big readers. They make things. They process the world. And so part of why I'm going back this January, actually just at the end of this week.
Oh, you are?
Is, oh, yes.
Same place?
Same place.
Got to be colder now.
It's warmer there than it is here. And everybody thinks
a lot of places that are warmer than it is here this week anyway.
Very true.
So you're going back.
I'm going back. And so part of it is to shore up some of the connections I've made so that I can bring a group of students with me.
Oh, cool. Does physical exploration make a better artist?
Physical anything makes a better artist. You have to get out of your studio because the whole right only what you know about saw is why there's so much boring work. You have to get out. You have to experience. You have to see things that are new to you and then synthesize them through your work in order to talk to people about things that are new and interesting. Because otherwise, you just have a bunch of autobiography work about it being cold outside.
We're in the studio with Ursula Murray Husted. She's from UW Stout School of Art and Design. She specializes, what should I say, in...
Oh, I'm a comic artist.
You're a comic artist. It's interesting enough that she does what I just said, but she took a tour, kind of like Gilligan's Island, but it's a little north. The Arctic Circle. What was the town again or the place?
It's the Arctic Archipelago of Svalbard, which is an international territory of Norway.
Okay, Svalbard. When I went to the ArcticCircle.org website, I saw that there were several other artists. Was it tough for you to convince those whose job it was to invite people along that a comic artist was a good idea?
It's usually hard to convince people that a comic artist is a good idea. But I applied and I was accepted. It was kind of funny because in the first couple days, we'd all be meeting each other. And we had the biographies of everybody. And there were some really amazing people there doing really impressive things, really famous people. Mm-hmm. New York Times bestselling authors and architects and all these amazing people. And they kept looking at me and going, oh, you're the cartoonist. Yep, that's me.
Cool.
So it's it's how I see the world, and it's the kind of work that I produce.
Where can we see your work?
You can go to UrsulaMurrayHusted.com if you'd like to.
I think we do. Did you draw cartoons as a youngster, and did you do them as a teen in the school newspaper? Where did this all come from?
Oh, I drew cartoons and comics incessantly. I did it pretty much to the exclusion of anything else. My first, I guess, syndicated comic was in my college newspaper at Marshall University. But I've always drawn cartoons both to amuse myself and to annoy other people. And I'm lucky enough that that's something that I do now professionally, and I get to teach it professionally.
Are cartoons viewed as great art? Is that a quest of yours to make them perceived in a great light? I mean, we know familiar cartoonist names, but are there graphic comic masters out there?
Oh, yes.
Or maybe a world.
To answer, yeah. That there's all sorts of amazing people who are producing work.
Who are idols of yours?
Oh, Carl Barks, the original Uncle Scrooge artist in the 1940s and 50s, has produced what I think is just about the best work that humanity has produced. I'm also a big fan of Will Eisner, who did The Spirit and then went on to not pioneer but to elaborate on the idea of the graphic novel in the 1970s. I love Linda Berry, who teaches down in the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Okay.
Alison Bechdel. For me, it's not so much, oh, comics are art, and you need to understand that comics are art. It's that comics are wonderful and that this is something that you should be reading and you should be understanding, because it's not just words. It's not just pictures. Comics is this crystalline form of you read the words at the same time that you see the pictures are connected to them. And so it's an art form that's unlike any other art form.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not you think they're art, if it makes you happy, go for it.
Is there a primary purpose of comics? Because I wrote three: to satirize, to amuse, or to comment. Can you do all of them, all of the above? Do you focus on one?
Oh, I think it depends on the artist and what the artist is trying to do. Comics is a media, not necessarily a genre.
Okay.
So you have people like Art Spiegelman, who won the Pulitzer for doing a book called Mouse, which is autobiographical about him talking to his father's experiences about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And that's taught in elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And then you have people like Charles Schulz, who did Peanuts, who talked about melancholy and the painfulness of childhood at the same time as having it in every daily newspaper strip section in the country.
Sure.
So these are both comic masters, but they're trying to do different things and succeeding in similarly successful ways at very different aims.
Describe to us, if you can or would, what was a piece of artwork that was a product of your trip? How would you turn what you viewed into a comic?
So what I've been working on, and I haven't finished it yet because I still have an awful lot of information to go through, and comics is a very slow process, both writing and drawing. I'm working on a series of short autobiographical vignettes for what it was like for me to go on this trip, what it was like to learn to sail a tall ship, a three-masted barkentine, what it was like to work with other artists, to work with the scientist who was on the trip, to talk to the authors, to see polar bears, to see reindeer, in the hopes of both sort of getting my point of view on what the planet is like as a whole and what this trip was like in particular, in the hopes that people will be able to understand my experience. Autobiography is very new to me.
So we'll see you in the comic. Are you a caricature or what are you?
Kind of short and kind of gingery, so that's pretty much what I'll look like in the comic.
Okay. We'll recognize you?
Hopefully.
Well, now that I've seen you, I'll look for you. Very nice talking to you. What an interesting trip. I'd love to talk to you after you come back from the next one. You're going to scout so that you can take students eventually.
Correct. I'm going back to spend a little bit more than a week in Longyearbyen, which is the main city.
How's that spelled? No, never mind.
Surprisingly easy, just as it sounds.
Oh, okay.
So now I've had 24 hours of daylight with lots and lots and lots of people around. Oh. And so now I'm going to have 24 hours of darkness with the northern lights and being land-based. So it's sort of the corollary to my boat trip, but also, again, to cement the relationships and make it so I can take students there.
And where will you be? In a hotel somewhere?
I'm staying in a guest house.
A guest house. Oh, wow. I've heard that the northern lights in that neck of the woods can bring a person to tears.
It's supposed to be spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because it's so far north that the colors are less. So it's more on the green spectrum, but the intensity is really, really strong.
Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis, one of those things that I'm not sure any artist, even a Rembrandt, could have depicted well.
I never try to do justice to the things that I see because I'm not a camera, right? I can only talk about my experiences visually. I'm sure if I can convince people to go see the Northern Lights through visually talking about them in my comics, then I'll feel like that will be of more than a success than duplicating the Northern Lights themselves.
Other than your website, do you have published comics?
Oh, what? Certainly.
Where are they?
If you put my name into Amazon.com, you can come up with my most recent book, The Lines of Valletta.
Okay.
It's a story of two cats looking for the meaning of life in Malta.
That's right. I read you're a cat person.
I'm pro-dog as well, but I am on the cat side of things. Cats are deep animals, I think.
They are.
They're like people.
That's a whole nother discussion there. Thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Over the Tavern will run through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Ole and Lena's 50th anniversary and vow renewal will play Friday through Sunday at the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Walk Two Moons Friday through Sunday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Auditions for the Odd Couple female version will be held on Saturday and Sunday from 12:30 to 3:30 p.m. at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Well, glad we got you back in there. Next week, comedian Tim Harmston generates a few Snickers. Oh, it kind of makes me hungry for a candy bar. A West Wisconsin woman who captures dogs on camera. And more. Always more on Spectrum West. Thanks, Jim Oliver. Thanks, Deb Brown. Thanks all the others who step in to make this job easier than it sounds. I'm Al Ross. This is Spectrum West. We'll see you again. Don't forget, Friday night, News and Classical Music Network, 7 p.m.